Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and politics. First of all, there's an astonishing new find that's going to help rewrite the history of Homo sapiens. A new fossil has been found that's going to force a lot of textbooks to revise their figures about when Homo sapiens first emerged on the African continent. And so we're going to talk about, well, the origin of the human race. How do we know exactly the sequence and the time frame that allowed Mother Nature to create Homo sapiens? And then we're going to say a few things about Donald Trump and the Paris Agreement. Since President Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord, people have been trying to analyze the debris from the fallout. And the question is, what's going to happen immediately? Well, you'd be surprised to find out that, well, nothing is going to happen immediately, because it takes about 3 years to pull out of the Paris Accord. And in 3 years, well, it's time for another election. So maybe things are not quite as bad as people think. Also, we'll say a few things about the South Pole. You know, climatologists have thought that the South Pole is basically stable on a scale of centuries. However, Larsen Ice Shelf C is about to break off any minute. And so it means that the Antarctic is not as stable as it used to be. And just remember that if the Antarctic were to completely melt sometime in the future, well, we'd be underwater right now. So we'll tell you a few things about what's going to happen to the South Pole. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today concerns the origin of Homo sapiens. A new fossil has been discovered in Morocco that may force a revision of our understanding of the origin of Homo sapiens. So first of all, let us explain how we know so much about the past, going back, well, millions of years. Well, there are roughly three ways in which we can date a fossil. The first is using radiation. It turns out that radioactive materials in our body, in our bones, decays with time, and so it's like a clock. By measuring the residual radiation in a fossil, we can calculate how much the radiation diminished over time, and then immediately, bingo, we can calculate how old it is. So using radioisotopes, we can date everything from ancient life forms to meteors, and even the Earth itself can be used because we have this clock, a very convenient clock, to measure the residual radiation that's still left in an object. The second way is using DNA. Believe it or not, DNA is a clock. DNA mutates at roughly a uniform rate over the thousands and millions of years, and thereby, by analyzing two life forms and calculating the percent difference between them, we can then calculate at what point they separated. So, for example, our closest evolutionary neighbor is the chimpanzee. And if you analyze the genes of chimpanzee and the genes of humans, well, there's about a 1% difference in our genes. Then you look at the chart, and then you ask yourself a simple question. How long does it take for DNA to mutate so that there's a 1% difference in the genome? Bingo, the answer is 6 million years. So we know that we separated from the chimps roughly 6 million years ago. But then something happened. Over the millions of years since we separated from the chimpanzees, our brains got bigger, we began to use tools, and we became Homo sapiens roughly 200,000 years ago, at least according to the textbooks. So about 200,000 years ago, said the textbooks, humans began to walk upright. And we began to use our hands, not for swinging in trees, but for using tools, using the opposable thumb. Now, what happened roughly 200,000 years ago? Well, we don't know. One theory is that it got cold in Africa. And as it got cold in Africa, the forest began to recede. Now, our ancestors apparently were forest creatures. In fact, we have tailbones because once upon a time we had tails. And we have opposable thumbs because we used to swing in trees. So the size of your opposable thumb and your index finger is roughly the size of a tree branch in Africa hundreds of thousands of years ago. And then we used to walk in the forward direction. We used to walk on our knuckles. And that's why our back, our sway back, hurts when we hit about 40 or so. Because from an engineering point of view, when we walk upright and we lurched backwards, freeing up our opposable thumb to make tools, there was a price to pay for walking upright. And the price we paid is to put an enormous amount of pressure on the small of the back. And that's what your back goes out roughly when you're about 40 years of age. So we're not sure, but we think the receding of the forest and the coming of the grasslands forced us to walk upright. We're not sure, but it freed up our opposable thumb so that we could use it for gathering food and for hunting and gathering. And so we think that about 200,000 years ago, there was a change in the climate of Africa. Now, what about the Neanderthals? And what about other species that may have existed of hominids at about the time that we were roaming the plains of Europe? Well, it turns out that the latest theory is that the Neanderthals were not our ancestors. We coexisted with the Neanderthals in northern Europe tens of thousands of years ago. And one theory is that perhaps we outcompeted them for food. They went extinct and we didn't. However, if you analyze our DNA, much to our surprise, we find that our DNA has a slight mixture of Neanderthal DNA. About 1% or so of our DNA can actually be traced back to the Neanderthals. Now, how do we know that? Because we have teeth. Teeth from the ancient Neanderthals, from several individuals that have a little bit of DNA in them, believe it or not. And you can actually extract the DNA from the teeth of the Neanderthals. And from that, you can then begin to analyze the genome of the DNA to calculate how much overlap there is between us and the Neanderthals. Now, believe it or not, roughly 50, 100,000 years ago, we coexisted with other branches of hominids. There were the Neanderthals and also the Denisovans. The Denisovans is another branch of humanity that was discovered purely by analyzing DNA. We don't know what they look like. We have very little fossil evidence from them, but apparently 50 to 100,000 years ago, we coexisted with two other ancient branches of hominids, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. Now, the key question is, what happened when we had the emergence of modern humans? Humans that look just like us. Humans that if you give them a shave and put them in a three-piece suit and put them on Wall Street, they look like all the other barbarians on Wall Street. Well, that's where this new discovery in Morocco comes in. Every textbook says that roughly 100, 200,000 years ago, modern humans began to walk the surface of the earth. Well, the new Moroccan study says no. 300,000 years ago, we had a branch of humanity that emerged in Morocco. Now, why would that force us to revise all our textbooks? If this result holds up, it means, first of all, Homo sapiens have been around a lot longer than we thought. Not 200,000 years, but 300,000 years. Also, there is this out-of-Africa theory that says that humanity emerged from a region near Ethiopia and East Africa. That's where we find most of the bones of our ancestors going back about 200,000 years. So the out-of-Africa theory had a corollary, and that is that humanity sprung from one site, one particular site near Ethiopia and East Africa. However, now we have an even older branch of humanity emerging in Morocco, which means that the out-of-Africa theory has to be revised a bit. That there was no one Garden of Eden. There was no one point that you can point to and say, aha, that's where humanity came from. It turns out that perhaps humanity came from all of Africa. Maybe we evolved from different branches of Homo sapiens that existed throughout Africa. Now, first of all, who was it that proposed the out-of-Africa theory to begin with? Believe it or not, it was Charles Darwin. He asked himself a simple question. If you want to find out where humans first evolved, then look at where our ancestors are most numerous. Because the longer a species stays in one area, the more branches you're going to get with time. Therefore, since we humans look like apes, Charles Darwin said, look for the place which has the most varieties of apes. Well, bingo. So, where do you find most variations that look like Homo sapiens? Well, you find many apes in Africa, and that's why Charles Darwin said that's where humanity came from. However, he didn't know whether there was a single Garden of Eden which spawned the human race, or whether humans emerged out of the entire continent. And so the latest theory seems to indicate that we came from all of Africa, not from just one particular point. Now, we should also point out that this result has to be checked. Fossils have to be looked at carefully. However, there's nearly a complete jawbone of this creature that apparently dates back 300,000 years. Now, how did they find the date? Well, they used something called thermoluminescence. It turns out that an object simply staying on the planet Earth absorbs radiation from the outside, radiation from cosmic rays, radiation from radioactive soil, and so any piece of material on the Earth has a little bit of energy, energy stored in it because of cosmic rays and subatomic particles and radiation. However, if you were to heat up this object, it begins to glow a little bit. That's right, because some of this ancient energy is then dissipated. And so this is called thermoluminescence. That is, thermo, you heat an object, and bingo, it begins to glow a bit. And by analyzing the amount of radiation that comes out of the object, you can more or less estimate how much radiation it absorbed. Now, since you know the rate at which objects absorb radiation, like cosmic rays, for example, bingo, you can use that as a clock. So by measuring the amount of light emitted when you heat an object, you can calculate roughly how old it is. And so that was the method they used to calculate the age of these fossils in Morocco. Also, to cross-check it, they also used radioactive dating, and it seemed to agree. Yes, these fossils date back 300,000 years, forcing a revision in our understanding of what created Homo sapiens. Well, the other big story that continues to dominate the headlines is the fallout from the recent decision by President Donald Trump to pull out of the Paris Accords. That was shocking in and of itself because almost 200 nations are signatories to the Paris Accords. And I've been getting a lot of emails about, well, what is it going to mean? Well, first of all, some of the emails that I get say, now, wait a minute, something's not right. The Constitution of the United States says that the Congress, that is the Senate, has to ratify treaties. And how can Donald Trump simply single-handedly pull out of the Paris Accords? Well, the answer is quite simple. You see, President Barack Obama realized that he did not have the votes to push through the Paris Accords through the United States Senate. So he did it by himself. That's why it's called the Paris Accords, not the Paris Treaty. It was never a treaty. And as a consequence, since President Barack Obama simply did it by fiat, then, of course, President Donald Trump can undo what President Barack Obama did. So you don't need permission from the United States Senate, okay, because it was never ratified by the Senate to begin with. Second, people are wailing and saying to themselves, oh, my God, is this the end of the world? Is President Donald Trump going to pull out of everything and collapse all the agreements and collapse all the progress that's being made? Well, let's slow down a bit. First of all, the treaty itself says it takes 3 years. 3 years to do a full pullout. And if you get to the calendar and look at where we're going to be in 3 years, why, we have another election. And at that point, there's going to be perhaps a new president. We don't know for sure. And so it means that in the next 3 years, well, not much is going to happen because it takes that amount of time to pull out of the treaty. So it's not all doom and gloom. However, there is, of course, several downsides to pulling out of the Paris Accords and also some upsides as well. First of all, we have to realize that there's been a lot of momentum built up because of the Kyoto Protocols and the Paris Accords. A lot of momentum. A lot of companies have taken the initiative. You see, there's not all doom and gloom. First of all, there's a lot of momentum built up in the last decade, momentum that cannot be dissipated just because one nation decides to pull out. There are a lot of projects in progress. There are a lot of agreements being made between corporations. There are a lot of plans to reduce our carbon footprint already in motion. And so you have to realize that there's a lot of momentum that's already been built up, political momentum, momentum initiated by states that can simply take the initiative, momentum built up by countries that want to be part of the future. And so it's going to be a lot more difficult to reverse the environmental momentum than some people suspect, because of the momentum that's being built up. Next, we also have technology, and that is breakthroughs have been made in the last 10, 15 years whose effect are going to ripple through the economy. First of all, take a look at solar and wind power. People have been talking about solar and wind since, I don't know when, decades and decades ago, but why don't we have windmills on every corner? Why don't we have solar collectors everywhere? Well, the problem is not solar technology or wind technology. They're quite advanced. The problem is storage. That is, where are you going to store the energy when the sun doesn't shine and the winds don't blow? Storage is the weak link in the whole chain. Now, how do you solve the problem? Well, by creating a better battery. And this is where private enterprise comes in when it comes to technology. Battery efficiency has been increasing, meaning that the price of batteries has been dropping by about 7% per year, a tremendous drop, mainly because inventors and engineers are now putting sizable amounts of their resources into creating a better battery. For example, Elon Musk has decided to take Tesla Motors and spin off an electric division to sell what are called super batteries. That is, batteries which can be used with solar and wind power when the sun doesn't shine and the winds don't blow. Even utilities now are looking at this. Now, think about it from the point of view of a large utility. You have to meet peak summer and peak winter demands. Because if you don't, you have all these customers who are complaining that they're burning up in the middle of summer and they're freezing their butts off in the middle of winter. And so you have to have overcapacity at these plants, which, of course, is a waste of time, a waste of energy, just because people in those few days of the year don't want to overheat or don't want to freeze. Now, let's say you had a battery that can even out the cycles. So you're not going to have to worry about peak summer or peak winter. Now you're talking. Now big utilities are saying, hey, perhaps this is the way to go, because then we don't have to worry about creating gigantic power plants that can meet peak summer and peak winter, even though peak summer and peak winter only take place a few days out of the year. And so utilities are also looking into this, and that is buying a new generation of batteries for home use and also commercial use. Also, as you know, the automobile industry is slowly making a transition away from fossil fuels to hybrids, then hybrids to electric cars, and then electric cars perhaps to fuel cell cars. Now, once again, the Japanese automakers are leading in this field. It turns out that fuel cell cars use electricity, but they don't have to have this internal combustion engine as a hybrid. In fact, you can go completely electric. You can go to fuel cells. Now, remember in high school, we learned about electrolysis. You get a glass of water. You put two electrodes inside, one plus, one minus, and bingo. All of a sudden, you had bubbles. Bubbles forming near the plus, bubbles forming near the minus electrodes. Well, that's the way to separate H2O into H and O, into hydrogen and oxygen. Then if you combine hydrogen and oxygen in a car, in a fuel cell car, what do you get? You get energy coming out. And what are the waste products? The waste product is H2O. In fact, some people claim that the waste product of a fuel cell car is so pure, so pure you can drink it. Now, when was the last time you saw someone drinking the waste products coming out of the tailpipe of a car? That'd be crazy, right? The fuel cells burn cleanly, and the waste product of a fuel cell burning hydrogen and oxygen is pure water. And so the Japanese, especially Toyota and other companies, are looking into the possibility of a hydrogen economy. Now, there are some criticisms of a hydrogen economy. First is safety. I mean, after all, hydrogen is potentially explosive, right? And it means that you might have fires and explosions at hydrogen refueling stations. But hey, give me a break. That's what we have in gasoline stations as well. Cars, when they collide, you have to worry about explosions because gasoline is highly refined, has a very high octane rating, and will explode. And so the criticism sometimes lodged against hydrogen doesn't hold up because gasoline is also quite explosive. Now, some people say you can't go to a hydrogen economy because you need a hydrogen refueling station every block. Well, yeah, but guess what? When gasoline came in, people criticized gasoline for saying that we'll have to have a gasoline pump at every block. Well, and what happened? Now we do have gasoline pumps on every block. And so many of the criticisms that were used against gasoline can also be used against hydrogen. But what happened to those objections against gasoline? Well, we simply got used to the fact that gasoline will explode at times, and we do have pumps on every block. So in other words, no big deal. And speaking about the weather, there's ominous news from the South Pole, and that is the Larsen Ice Shelf Sea is going to break apart, and a chunk of ice about the size of Delaware is going to break off from the South Pole. So the whole Larsen Ice Shelf's stability is in danger. Back in 2002, Larsen Ice Shelf B broke off from South Pole, and now we're seeing the breakup of Larsen Ice Shelf C. Now, why should we care? Well, first of all, realize that much of the weather on the planet Earth is governed by the North Pole and the South Pole, not to mention that much of the fresh water on the planet Earth is locked in to the North Pole and the South Pole. And if the South Pole were to completely melt, which, of course, no one expects to happen for perhaps millions and millions of years, but if the whole South Pole region were to melt, well, we would be underwater right now because about 50% of the population of the United States lives next to the coast. And so it would basically destroy the United States as we know it. And how fast has the breakup taken place? Well, scientists have been amazed at the rapidity with which it's taking place. 15 miles. 15 miles of the crack expanded in a period of just 1 week. That's incredible. Now, is it going to mean an immediate rise in sea level? And the answer is no, for the following reason. First of all, there's a difference between an ice sheet and an ice shelf. An ice shelf sits on water. So think of an ice cube that is floating in a glass of water. Even if the ice cube totally melts, it doesn't necessarily mean that the level of water is going to rise precipitously. However, the ice shelves, even though they rest on water, the ice sheets rest on land. And if they were to slide into the ocean, then sea levels would definitely begin to rise. So what's the danger? The danger is as the ice shelves begin to break off, it weakens the structural integrity of the entire ice sheet, meaning that it's going to be much easier for the ice sheet then to slide into the ocean, and that, of course, would be potentially catastrophic. Not only that, but scientists were rather shocked to find that underneath the ice, if you were to drill into the ice, there's a tremendous amount of, well, running water. Why is there so much running water under the ice? Because the ice is melting. And this was something that was not obvious to climatologists, because you can't see it. But now we know that if you look underneath the ice, you see that much of the ice is beginning to melt, creating underwater rivers. Now, this is dangerous because it means that the stability, not of the ice shelf, but the ice sheet, is now being called into question. So if the ice sheets were to become unstable and slide into the ocean, it would definitely cause a rise in sea level. And just remember that maps show that in the United States, if sea levels were to rise, then it means that certain cities could very well go underwater, like New Orleans, for example. Much of New Orleans is actually below sea level to begin with. And then we have cities like Boston, where you have a lot of landfill, not to mention New York City, San Francisco. We're talking about the major cities next to the ocean that are in danger as sea levels then begin to rise. And remember, this is happening not just in the South Pole, but also the North Pole. Our submarines, which have been visiting the North Pole for over 50 years, have clearly shown that the thickness of the Arctic ice has dropped by about 50% in the last 50 years. And so we're seeing the fact that the average temperature of the poles is rising much faster than the average temperature rise throughout the planet Earth. And so in some sense, the North Pole and the South Polar region are like the canaries in the mine shaft. When you first begin to see the effects of temperature rise, you'll see it first in the poles because the poles are rising much faster in temperature than the rest of the planet Earth. And so when President Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords, it's not just a question of American jobs. It's a question of life on the planet Earth as sea levels begin to rise, which means not just that cities are going to be underwater. It means that storms will throw a tremendous amount of water over the dikes, over the levees, paralyzing cities. That's what happened in New York City a few years ago when there was a nor'easter, which then thrust a tremendous amount of water into the New York subway system, paralyzing the city when the New York subway system was flooded by a nor'easter. So you don't have to have just sea level rise to paralyze a city. You can have storms like nor'easters, which would then paralyze a city by shooting tremendous amounts of water over the dikes and over the levees. That's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this has been the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. David Archer, an authority on the climate, and he's the author of a disturbing new book called The Long Thaw. What happens when the polar ice caps begin to thaw out? What happens when Greenland and Alaska begin to thaw out? What's going to happen to the climate of the Earth if we're beginning to see the long thaw? And once again, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. For a copy of today's program, once again, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about what happens if we do nothing. What happens if we let the greenhouse effect take over the planet? What's going to happen if we have a long thaw? Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first part of Exploration, we talked about, well, what could happen if the Paris Accords begin to collapse, because, of course, the United States is one of the leading industrial powers on the planet Earth, thereby creating tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide, which heats up the entire planet. So what's going to happen when we begin to see a melting of the ice caps? What happens if we have a long thaw? And so once again with us today is Professor David Archer, climatologist and author of the disturbing book, The Long Thaw.
Professor Archer, as a youth, how did you first get interested in science, and in particular, earth science?
I guess I looked to the earth, the functioning of the earth, the stable geochemical cycles of things like that, as something that's bigger than people are. I look to the natural world with a sort of reverence, and I think that's what brought me into the natural sciences, why I chose to study the oceans, actually, instead of forests or other planets or stars or something like that, is because I've always had a romantic love of boats, but now I ended up living in Chicago anyway, but that's just one of life's jokes, I guess.
Okay, well, let's get right into it. First of all, what is the relationship between carbon dioxide and global warming?
Well, carbon dioxide traps infrared light that tries to leave the atmosphere. It's like if you put a coat on in the wintertime, it traps some of the heat leaving your body, and so it allows your body to warm up. And the theory about CO2, how it affects the climate of the Earth and how much it affects the climate of the Earth, is over 100 years old now. It's very, very solid science. That if there were no greenhouse effect, we wouldn't be able to explain why the Earth isn't in a deep freeze, or the climate of Venus, or lots of other things. It's very solid science.
And, well, talking about Venus, some people call Venus the greenhouse planet. Why would a carbon dioxide atmosphere for Venus make it the greenhouse planet?
Well, there's 70 atmospheres of CO2 in the atmosphere of Venus, so it's very, very thick greenhouse forcing. It has a very strong greenhouse effect. Actually, Venus is also a very reflective planet. That's why it's so bright in the night sky. So if there were no greenhouse effect on either Earth or Mars, even though Venus is closer to the sun, it would be colder than the Earth because it reflects away so much of the sunlight that would heat it up.
Okay, well, now let me play devil's advocate. Some people say, bah, humbug. The current warming of the Earth is a natural cycle. The Earth is naturally warming up. Other people say that it's the sun. Yeah, the sun. The sun is causing the Earth to rise in temperature, not human activity. And other people say that the Earth is cooling. What are your thoughts?
Sometimes it's even the same people who one year say the Earth is not warming up and the next year say that it's warming up, but it's entirely natural. You know, ours is a contentious species. We tend to take both sides of positions, even if there's nothing to base assertions on. If they sound good, they still can carry some weight. The Earth has clearly been getting warmer. That's measured, even though it's been a cool summer here in Chicago. Overall, the average temperature of the Earth is rising. The sun has not been getting brighter. We have good measurements of the intensity of the sun from satellites going back a few decades, I don't know exactly, but it's not, there's a sunspot cycle that makes the sun brighter and cooler over 11 years, but there isn't a long-term trend at all in the sun getting brighter. So, you know, people say what they, you know, think people want to hear, and people hear what they want to hear, but there is, you know, objective reality. We can measure these things and say what's really going on.
Okay, well, some of the critics say, okay, so maybe the Earth is getting warmer. However, human activity, some people would say, no, it's not human activity. So what's the reason that many scientists believe that it's human activity causing the current warming?
We can estimate how much warming to expect from rising CO2 concentrations in the air. That's actually boiled down into a number called the climate sensitivity, which is how much the climate would warm if you doubled the CO2 concentration. And the first estimate of the climate sensitivity of the Earth actually goes back to Svante Arrhenius in the year 1896, over 100 years ago, who predicted that doubling CO2 should raise the temperature of the Earth by about 6 degrees centigrade. And now they say it's something like 2.5 to 5 degrees centigrade. It's really not that much of a change. It's a tricky calculation because it's very complex the way that CO2 interacts with light. But this is by sort of normal non-political rules of science, this is a done question.
So if you, let's say, were to remove humanity from the planet Earth, then you're saying that the Earth would not be so warm as it is today?
There was a model exercise conducted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So these are climate models developed all over the world, and they all subjected their models to one scenario where you tell the models about the rising concentrations of greenhouse gases, and then another scenario where you only have the natural climate forcings, like the intensity of the sun or volcanic eruptions can cool down the planet. And if you tell the models about the greenhouse gases, they can explain the warming that has been detected since sort of the 1970s. The warming, the temperature since the 1970s, that's the smoking gun for global warming. If you don't tell the models about the greenhouse gases, they don't warm up in the same way. So if you want to say that the warming is real, but it's caused by, you know, something that we don't understand in the climate system, which, you know, there will always be things that we don't understand, not only would you like to come up with an explanation of what that something would be in order to settle the question, but you would also have to figure out why the CO2 is not causing the warming that we attribute it to. It's sort of like if you catch, I make an analogy in my classes, to a murder mystery, because people always put on their thinking caps when they're reading murder mysteries. They don't always put on thinking caps when they're thinking about science. But so you catch the butler with a gun in his hand and the dead guy, and there's, you know, smoke coming out of the gun, and your partner is sort of a contrarian guy. You're a policeman trying to you know, solve the crime. Your partner says, "Well, I think the chauffeur did it." But, you know, for your partner to convict the chauffeur, he's first going to have to explain to the jury what the butler was doing with the smoking gun in his hand. In other words, translating back out of the analogy, if we want to say that the warming is not from CO2, we have to explain what's wrong with greenhouse theory, that the CO2 should not be causing the warming.
Well, if you look at temperature rises over the last many centuries, you see a gradual warming, because after all, there was an ice age 10,000 years ago. But some scientists say that there's a spike that is quite anomalous that is taking place in the last 100 years, and that's proof that it's human activity because it's not part of the natural cycle. What are your thoughts?
Well, there is this large-scale glacial interglacial cycle that you refer to. There's also a sort of a milder, much shorter, I don't know if it's a cycle or just sort of fluctuations, but back sort of between the 1300s and the 1700s was a time of generally cool temperatures called the Little Ice Age. So you could, you know, ice skate in Amsterdam and things like that that you no longer can do. And that is correlated with a lack of sunspots, which indicates that the sun was cooler. We don't have satellite solar intensity data going back to the 1600s, but we have observations of a number of sunspots that date back to, you know, Galileo's invention of the telescope in the 1600s, and there's a correlation between the number of sunspots and those sorts of climate changes. I think the evolution of climate up until the 70s, though, can be explained pretty well by natural forcings. It isn't until the 70s that the human-forced climate signal started to come up out of the noise of natural variability.
Now, also, some people say that the last decade was perhaps the hottest decade ever recorded. How far back does that go? Because, of course, perhaps during the dinosaur era, things were a lot warmer back then.
Sure. So there are thermometer records that go back to about 1860 from Fahrenheit's invention of the thermometer. They can piece together the temperature of the Earth going back further than that with what they call proxy records of temperature from the widths of tree rings or from chemical measurements they can make in ice cores or sediment cores or something like that. And so they can record, they can figure out that the Little Ice Age was cooler, and then there was a period of general warmth before that called the medieval optimum climate. Those records generally go back 1,000 or 2,000 years, and the conclusion of the last IPCC report, which summarized climate, you know, for non-specialists and for, you know, for the community outside of your own field, very useful, very, very authoritative reports. They concluded that current temperatures are warmer than they have been in 1,300 years. But if you go back millions of years, you're absolutely right. During peaking about 50 million years ago, the Earth was it felt tropical to the poles, and there was no ice anywhere to be found. And this is thought to be due to higher CO2 levels in the atmosphere at that time. We don't have as good ways of estimating what the CO2 concentration was when you go that far back in time. But the evidence that has been pieced together is all consistent, that there's sort of million-year or tens of million-year fluctuations in the natural CO2 levels of the Earth that sort of drifts up and down like that.
Now, scientists that have gone to the poles to extract ice cores, essentially getting ice that was deposited perhaps several hundred thousand years ago to maybe a million years ago,
yes,
they see that carbon dioxide levels and temperature levels go up and down in unison like two roller coasters. What does that mean?
It's rare that you find such beautiful correlations in nature, I think. It's just astonishing. Al Gore showed this plot in his movie. That's sort of how iconic it is. It's an astonishing thing.
So, Professor Archer, ice core data shows that carbon dioxide levels go up and down.
But the temperature of the Earth goes up and down, and the two of them go up and down like two synchronized roller coasters. So what does that mean if the ups and downs of carbon dioxide exactly mirror the ups and downs of temperatures on the Earth?
Somehow, the orbit of the Earth around the sun has these wobbles in it, and that is thought to pace the progress of the ice age cycle, when the ice sheets are going to grow or when they're going to collapse. But somehow the CO2 concentration of the air follows along with the changes in the climate, so that when the orbit tells the ice sheet to make the Earth warmer, the CO2 says, okay, I can pitch in some to that too, and so it amplifies these climate changes.
So which comes first? The temperature rise comes first and then the carbon dioxide rise, vice versa? What's the relationship?
It's a back and forth cause and effect. It's a feedback system. So to ask which one is driving which, I think, is like asking if you see two figure skaters, you know, twirling each other around on the ice, which it's to try to analyze the trajectory of one without paying attention to the other would make no sense. On the deglaciation, the transition from the ice age climate to the present day climate, the first thing that started to happen, as recorded in the Antarctic ice cores, is a change in temperature in Antarctica, and then a few centuries later, the CO2 concentration started to rise. But then the total change in climate took much longer than a few centuries. So there's no way you could explain the climate transition from the glacial world to the interglacial world without taking into account the change in the CO2 concentration. So it's a feedback loop of cause and effect. It isn't just one or the other drives the thing.
So summarizing, if you were to go back 10,000 years, we had the Ice Age. Things have been warming up in the last 10,000 years. But is it safe to say that recently, in the last several decades, there's been a spike in temperature rise, and that's due to human activity?
That's more or less true. Actually, the interglacial period is called the Holocene. And the early Holocene, right at about 10,000 to 6,000 or 8,000 years ago, may have been warmer than today. The Earth's orbit around the sun was in a different, you know, slightly different configuration than it is today. So it almost seemed like there was a peak in warming and then maybe a little bit of gradual decline driven by the Earth's orbit over the millennia. But certainly over the last 1,000 years or two, the temperatures of the last decade are anomalously high.
Okay, let's talk about the present. What's happening with glaciers and the North Pole and the South Pole? We see evidence of the melting of the glaciers around the Earth. That's why scientists are finding so many mammoth bones and even human remains, because the glaciers are receding. So what evidence do we have that the Earth is warming?
Well, we just have the thermometers. I mean, for direct measurements of temperature, thermometers are hard to beat. But the mountain glaciers are almost all melting. It's difficult for a glaciology graduate student to find an advancing mountain glacier to study anymore, because there are very few that exist. There's warming detected in the deep ocean. Fairly deep, not all the way to the bottom of the ocean, but you can see the warmth sort of penetrating the ocean. In the high latitudes, the Arctic is melting like crazy. It's the sea ice covering the Arctic Ocean is melting much faster than any of the models a few years ago predicted. The year 2007 was a sort of a train wreck for the sea ice up there. It just plummeted. Actually, in the southern hemisphere, it's not so clear what's going on. In the interior of Antarctica, it actually is cooling, which is not, that's something that the climate models also predict. So that's not a discrepancy. But there's also not been a meltback in the sea ice in the Antarctic either. And I gather there's still some messiness about that issue, that maybe it's caused by changes in the circulation of the atmosphere caused by the ozone hole, which is a completely different sort of phenomenon. Ozone is it's a greenhouse gas, but it also absorbs ultraviolet light, and so it heats up the air that it's in the stratosphere. That's why the stratosphere gets warmer as you go higher up in the stratosphere, because of ozone. So by wiping out the ozone in the spring of the Antarctic every year, that changes the dynamics of the air, and maybe that's responsible for a lack of global warming signature generally in the southern hemisphere. Actually, there has been very intense warming on the Antarctic Peninsula, which kind of sticks out from Antarctica up into the slightly lower latitudes. And so you read sometimes in the newspapers about these ice shelves, these very thick floating shelves of ice, hundreds of meters thick. You could walk on it and not know that you weren't on solid land, that suddenly have been collapsing. Places that have been covered by ice for, you know, since the last ice age, suddenly are ice free. So there are signs of the climate change every place. The growing seasons have gotten longer. The Arbor Day Foundation has published maps of climate zones of where you should plant begonias or tulips or whatever, and those have changed since 1990. There are all kinds of signs. It's more obvious in some parts of the world than others. Actually, in Chicago, there hasn't been much climate change since the 70s, but if you go up to Alaska, the climate changes have been huge. So, you know, local experience is not necessarily a good guide, but you put it together into a global average, and it's very clear.
And also, you mentioned how it affects plants and also animals with the changing of the growing season, but also insects, right? Some people are saying that the West Nile virus, which has been spreading through urban centers, is in part driven by global warming. And then in the future, malaria could also spread. What are your thoughts?
I'm not a public health person. I don't really know a lot about the details of this, but people that I talk to are very concerned about the effects of climate on public health. I think the World Health Organization estimated last year that there are 150,000 deaths a year that can be attributed to climate change. Now, obviously, that's a, you know, statistical sort of question that's not so easy to answer. But the people that I talk to say that's a very realistic. They have models of disease transmission and everything, and the climate and the insect vectors that carry the diseases are part of those models. Now, that being said, you can do a lot about malaria itself just with, you know, mosquito nets and you know, insecticides and things like that. And so I have heard the argument that instead of paying to reduce CO2 emissions, we should just pay for mosquito nets. I don't think the tropical diseases are the main reason why we want to worry about changing the climate.
Okay, now let's talk about the thrust of your book, which talks about the future, up to 100,000 years into the future. Well, first of all, let's talk about the coming decades. What's happening with the temperature on the Earth? Projections out to 50 years, 100 years. Some people say that on a scale of decades, major metropolitan cities like New Orleans, Boston, New York, San Francisco could be partially underwater. So what are the projections for, let's say, 50 to 100 years?
Well, one of the big uncertainties there is what we do with CO2 emissions and energy. But you can take as a baseline just to talk about what they call a business-as-usual scenario, which is a projection of how much energy people will need and how much fuel they will burn to get it if there were no constraint from changing climate. And the temperature changes responding to that would put the Earth warmer than it has been in millions of years. So saying what exactly the impacts of that would be on, you know, the corn harvest in Iowa or something like that is really not a very easy thing to do. With respect to sea level, the question is all how quickly can the major ice sheets respond to the changes in climate. The models that have been developed in the past don't respond nearly as strongly as the observations that glaciologists actually can make in Greenland and Antarctica about how the ice streams flowing into the ocean respond to the changes in climate. You can measure more ice quakes in Greenland with seismometers than you could 5 years ago. And the ice sheets, the ice streams flowing from the ice sheets into the ocean are accelerating. So it's really kind of anybody's guess how long it takes for sea level to change. There were events in the past called Heinrich events when the Laurentide ice sheet, which was in North America, every 8,000 years or so during the last ice age would just collapse into the ocean. And there would be this armada of icebergs in the North Atlantic, and they would carry little rocks and sand and stuff like that that would then deposit on the seafloor, and there's no way for those to get there other than these icebergs. And so that's how we know about these events today, is by finding those layers of rocks on the bottom of the Atlantic. Those seemed like they took a century or a few centuries, and they seem, some of them, to have raised sea level by many meters, which is much more than any of the ice sheet models predict for the global warming climate event. But I think most everybody thinks that these ice sheet models are just lacking some essential physics at this point.
Well, some people say that the real problem with sea level rise is simply the thermal expansion of ocean water with the rising temperature of the Earth. And since the Earth is rising in temperature, the oceans are going to expand no matter what happens to the North Pole or the South Pole.
Well, that's absolutely true, and that's part of the forecast for sea level rise by the year 2100, which is about a half a meter or so. Something like half of that sea level rise is caused by exactly this effect, the expansion of the seawater. It's like the mercury in the thermometer that fills up more of the thermometer when the temperature goes up. That's a process that will keep going for centuries. So the forecast for the year 2100 is not sort of the end of the line. That's sort of just the beginning for the thermal expansion of seawater. The other half of the sea level rise that's actually in the IPCC forecast for the year 2100 is melting of smaller mountain glaciers like in the Andes and the Alps. And actually, a lot of the sea level rise today can be attributed to mountain glaciers in the state of Alaska. It just happens to be a place where there's lots of ice frozen on mountains and where the climate changes are very intense. But it's some astonishingly large fraction of the sea level rise comes from Alaska.
Okay,
just as a curiosity.
Okay, so what does that mean for the average person who has to make decisions, enormous decisions, in the next few years about fossil fuel consumption, about investment in solar energy, and so on and so forth? What changes in their lifestyle should we expect in the coming decades?
Well, you know, lifestyles could change because we adapt to new energy technologies. Most of the CO2 emissions that can be avoided in the next few decades actually come from improvements in efficiency.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the second part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest today has been Professor David Archer. He's a professor at the Department of the Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago. And the disturbing book that he talked about is The Long Thaw. So what happens when CO2 levels simply rise unabated into the atmosphere? What happens when the poles begin to melt? What happens when gigantic storms ravage our cities? And for that matter, what happens when some of our cities go underwater? Well, these are just some of the scenarios that are mentioned in the book, The Long Thaw, who is a professor at the University of Chicago, and he's an expert in computational ocean chemistry and, of course, climatology. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this has been a special edition of Exploration. We began Exploration by talking about this new find, which pushes back our understanding of the evolution of Homo sapiens. And then, of course, we went to the aftershock of President Donald Trump pulling out of the Paris Accords. And what does that mean? And then we just had our special guest today in the second half of Exploration, Professor David Archer. He's a professor at the University of Chicago and an expert on the climate. And the book, a very disturbing book, is called The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. In other words, we're not just changing the atmosphere of the planet Earth for the next several decades. No. We're talking about putting enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere so the effects will be felt 100,000 years into the future. So once again, the book is called The Long Thaw, and the author is David Archer of the University of Chicago. Good day.